I think I'm far better acquainted with many of you than I was this time yesterday. And some of you know what I'm referring to. We had some very interesting rap sessions last night. This morning our subject is dating and courtship. Of course, I suppose that is a familiar subject and practice to most of you. I want to take my text today from Fenton's translation. Proverbs 18:22. Fenton translates Proverbs 18:22 to read like this. Who finds a wife finds what is good, but a risky gift from the Lord. That kind of grows on you, doesn't it? It's a real privilege to be assisted this morning by our distinguished panel members and joy to learn to know some of them and renew acquaintance with others of them. Our subject is narrowing the risk in mate selection. Narrowing the risk in mate selection. Shall we bow our hearts in prayer? We realize this morning, Father, that the first man had direct guidance from God in the selection of his mate. But since that time, various cultures devised various systems, which with varying degrees of difficulty thrust that responsibility on each of us as men and upon women in their search for a husband. So this morning, as we look at the way our culture has prescribed that we go about this task of mate selection, give us the benefit of insight that will help us to be aware of the system so that we might use it to the maximum advantage, so that we might be hurt by it as little as possible. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. There is nothing like being married. If you're happily married, there's nothing like it. And if you're unhappily married, there's still nothing like it. There is just nothing like being married. And if you are going to find in marriage the happiness that most of us seek, the battle is more than half won in the selection process. Unfortunately, most of us are in some kind of mad romantic fog during this selection process. And we wake up out of the fog sometimes by God's good grace, happily married, but frequently wondering where we were when the brains were passed out. Now, I want to talk, first of all, this morning about our courtship system, and then I want to talk about the range of physical contact in our courtship system, and then hopefully help you see some screening factors that will enable you, if you retain a reasonable semblance of rationality in the courtship process, to narrow the risk in making that final selection. You can never eliminate the risk. You never take a bigger chance than when you get married. Now, the more you can learn of the courtship system, and the more disciplined your approach to it as a mate selection process, the less apt you are to be hurt by it, and the more apt you are to find in it a way of choosing an acceptable mate. But as careful as you may be, you can never eliminate the risk entirely. I don't know that that would be desirable if it were possible, for part of the romance and adventure of living is caught up in this ability to take risks. However, most of us who are thrilled with risk-taking also like to have the good feeling that the odds turned out in your favor. So let's take a look at courtship as it's evolved in our culture as our mate selection process. In the 1920s, this was still largely a very new process. Our grandparents, my grandparents, knew very little of dating as a mate selection process. Really became the vogue in our culture during the 1940s. The automobile furnished the technological means of getting away from the parents and providing an environment where a man and woman, even in the wintertime, could stay warm and be alone. And in the 1940s, our dating system became the prominent method by which we choose our mates. If we were to look at it as it divides itself into about five periods, it would look something like this. First of all, we have the initial dating period. Then we have a random dating period. And then we have a steady dating period. And then we have a pre-engagement arrangement. And then we have engagement. Now, in a recent survey, 1966, was indicated that 32.8% of the students began steady dating in junior high school. In my opinion, this is too young to begin steady dating. I happen to be among the group of people who feel that one of the most disastrous experiments in education in our society has been the junior high school. I do not feel that young men and women understand the meaning of that word junior. I think that, by and large, the seventh graders feel that they should be doing what the freshmen in high school are doing. That the eighth graders feel they should be doing what the 11th graders are doing. And the ninth graders feel they should be doing what the 12th graders are doing. So that we, in the junior high school social context, have provided an institutional vehicle that has encouraged emotional relationships between male and female of too deep a serious, too deep an emotional level and too serious for the age to handle properly. The initial dating experience in our culture usually occurs somewhere during junior high school. I think in our movement, our particular danger is going from here to here to here too fast. I think this stage of dating needs to be prolonged over several years. Now, it's no fun to grow up in our culture today. We were talking before coming to the platform this morning, this period of adolescence, which has a way of expanding rather than contracting, presents young people with some very difficult problems to handle. The discovery dawns upon us as girls about 12 or 13 that there's some sort of magnetism between male and female. The fellas get the idea a couple years later. It's a rather pathetic part of growing up. But from then until we're 20 and 22, we have to come to grips with some very powerful and explosive emotional forces. And in the meantime, make the three most important decisions of our life. Decisions regarding our faith, our life's work, and our mate. Let me clarify what I meant when I said extending to 20 and 22. For over 50% of the young women in our culture who will be married are married by the time they are 20 and a half. And over 50% of the young men in our culture who are going to be married are married by the time they are 22 and a half. Now, that should be of some encouragement to you older young ladies that are here, for over half of the men are still left when you are 22 and a half. There are many advantages to extending the random dating period. Each of us needs to feel adequate as a male or female. And the appropriate period in our culture to build up that feeling of adequacy is in this time of random dating. If we have come into the 15 to 18 year period where dating really becomes a vital part of our lives, with a comfortable identity as males and females, that is, if we as fellas are glad that we're men and we're comfortable with our masculinity, and if we as young ladies are comfortable with the sexual identity that we have, moving into the 15 to 18 year period when dating becomes a major role in our lives, we then have the opportunity to learn what it's like to get close to someone of the opposite sex. Now, the more males that a female can contact and learn to know, the more advantages accrue to her as a person. First of all, she becomes convinced that she is an attractive female. Second of all, in dating a number of males, she has the opportunity to build up a composite of her ideal mate, taking a little bit from this fella and a little bit from that fella and a little bit from some other fella. She builds her own private portrait of Prince Charming. Now, this is an invaluable screen later on when that final selection has to be made. And likewise, the male who contacts a number of females in this concentrated dating period
becomes convinced that he is an attractive male, he also has the advantage of building a composite from each companion in dating of those characteristics that he eventually hopes to find in his final selection. Now, the fears of the male and female during dating are different. They're just as intense, but they're different. Our culture assigns to the woman a less aggressive role than to the man. And tomorrow morning, we're going to be dealing specifically with gender as it relates to our lives as men and women, how different the world of the man is from the world of the woman. The fear that the male has in the dating period is, what if I ask her and she says no? And the fear that the female has is, what if he doesn't ask me? Two very different fears, but both equally disturbing, equally painful. Now, it is my opinion that people reacting to these fears are the ones who are most apt to skip from an initial dating period to the steady dating period. The young people who want to go steady are usually reflecting some insecurity. They're usually reflecting a reluctance to accept this risk of either not being asked or being rejected. Now, as churches, I've already remarked in separate rap sessions about this, but let me repeat it again this morning. We have a tendency to encourage steady dating rather than random dating. You let a boy and girl be seen sitting together a couple Sundays in a row in church, and many of the older people, who of course only have the interests of the young people at heart, will come to the girl and say, well, you know, I see things are going very nicely between you and John. And then the next Sunday, they're not sitting together. And the older folks will come and say, oh, what's happened to you and John? Now, this is picked up by our younger people. And many times, once a fellow has had two or three dates with a girl, her girlfriends consider him her private property, and vice versa. Once a guy has had two or three dates with a girl, his peers consider that girl to be his private property. And I say that is an unhealthy shortcutting of the dating process that is going to project young people many times farther along in this schedule of physical contact that I'm about to put on the board. For during the dating years, the name of our dating game is contact. And dates are just not much fun if there is no contact. There are five stages of physical contact leading to marriage. Number one, holding hands. I remember when I started to date, and we used to go for walks. I wasn't old enough to have the family car. And we'd walk along, you know, and her hand would swing and my hand would swing. And I'd say, next time it comes my way, I'm going to catch it. Wonder what she'll do then. Then there's necking. And that's activity above the shoulders. Then there's petting. And that's activity above the waist. Then there's heavy petting. That's activity below the waist. Notice the laughter die down. And then there's intercourse. Now these are the five levels of physical contact that go on during the courtship process leading to marriage. The New Testament says this must be reserved for marriage. Many of us feel that the line must stop. Notice I'm protecting myself. Much, much before this, if we are going to maintain control of the dating situation. Above all factors precipitating marriage, premature physical involvement should not be one of them. It's a tragedy when young people are propelled into the most serious choice of their life, short of their faith, because they went too far, too fast, and felt this was the only thing they could do and be honorable. That's not a very wise reason to take a man or a woman to be your wife. Now can you see why I say we should expand the random dating period? I think many adults feel that the first date or two, young people are apt to get seriously involved in these stages of contact. And we more or less feel, well, you start random dating, then you're going to be a rounder. Intimacy between members of the opposite sex builds up very gradually, and Lee Master says that one of the advantages of our dating system is that of gradual commitment. Now, if we encourage random dating, it is highly unlikely that in the course of dating several fellas or several girls, they are going to become heavily involved in deep, emotionally explosive levels of contact. They are much more likely to have less contact, but more exposure to what the opposite sex is like. Now, both fellas and girls are apt to be hurt in this process. For the prevailing emotional attitude of the female in courtship is romanticism. Girls are more in love with the process of being in love, with the feeling of being in love. And again, tomorrow morning we'll be dealing with some of the basic biological and psychological reasons that this is so. Fellas, on the other hand, are more motivated by eroticism in courtship. The young man feels his strongest urges for sexual gratification between the years of 18 and 25. These urges will not reach their peak in the lives of women until their early 30s. And in the dating courtship, this poses problems for both. The insecure girl fears if she doesn't give in to the deep needs of the fella for some physical gratification, that she will be left out in the courtship process. But there's a lot of threats here to the fella too, because the fella can really be taken in by a face and a figure. And it's a tragedy to be hooked on a face and a figure, marry the face, marry the figure, and find after marriage that there's no person behind the face and the figure. And time does things to faces and figures. Faces wrinkle and figures sag. As a little aside here, do you know why we sag down and wrinkle down rather than sag up and wrinkle up? It so happens that atmospheric pressure at better than 14 pounds per square ounce of the surface of our body is pulling our skin every moment that we are standing erect toward the center of the earth. And even the most resilient of skins can only take that so long. And then there are some bags under the eyes, and there's some sags under the chin, and there are a few sags and bags elsewhere. Well, I'll get away from that one. Now, what we've tried to do so far is to show you a little bit about when dating became the prominent date selection process in our culture, a little bit about how it is divided into various stages. We've emphasized the importance of that random period of dating for the purpose of making both male and female feel secure in their sexual adequacy, and having the advantage of building up composites against which future mate selections can be measured. Now let me say this. To shortcut that random dating period is to expose your eventual marriage to an extra risk for extramarital affairs. The second prevailing cause for extramarital affairs stems from feelings of sexual inadequacy. And if we move our young people along through this dating process, and two young people get married before they really are convinced that they're as attractive to the opposite sex as their peers, they may get married, get their new car, get their apartment, get their babies, and then they reach that Peggy Lee stage of life when they're saying, is that all there is? And if in this premarital period of dating they have not satisfied the need for feelings of sexual adequacy, they're going to regress back to this random dating bit. And there are very few married women with two or three children who look very kindly on a man that feels like he has to random date to reassure himself that he's a man. And there are very few men who are willing to let their wife go back and make up what she missed during the teenage period. So many people who try to shortcut this mate selection process and go from initial dating to steady dating to engagement to marriage too quickly sow the seeds that later on will come to fruition in extramarital affairs. Now, One last segment, and I think I can do this in about 4 or 5 minutes, and we can get to our panel, because I'm sure they're going to have some valuable contributions to make to our consideration this morning. Males that we as females date, or females that we as males date, that woman, that man, that presents to us the least risk and the greatest possible chance for success in marriage. Well, let me give you a few things that, as a psychologist, I would like to use to screen potential marriage candidates. Tierman studied 30 years ago success in marriage, and the study has become a rather classic in the field because subsequent research findings have tended to confirm his original research. He worked with 792 couples, and that's a pretty big sample. And what he discovered was more of those who were successfully married reported to him that their parents were successfully married than those who were unsuccessfully, than those of the sample who were unsuccessfully married. In other words, parental success in marriage is the largest single predictor of child success in marriage. So that one of the things, if I was a young man or a young woman in this mate selection process again, that I certainly would be looking for is, what is the marriage of my potential mate? What does the marriage of his parents or her parents look like? For you see, our society prepares young people for marriage very, very poorly. You have to gain more training to drive an automobile in this culture than you do to get married. And if you've been fortunate enough to grow up in a marriage where a man and a woman have related successfully, you have adopted by identification and association many of the attitudes that are essential to success in marriage. You've learned it just by the good fortune of being born to a couple who knew how to relate together successfully in marriage. Well, you say, what if you came? What if I came from a home where my mother and father were divorced? Then it would seem to me all the more critical that I try to find in my mate selection process a man, if I was a young woman, a woman, if I was a young man, whose parents related successfully. Because if two people from broken homes marry, the risk is increased, not narrowed. Now, something else Tierman found out about these couples, and that was that most of those who were successfully married related relatively happy childhoods. Another thing he found was that the home discipline in the early years was not too severe nor too frequent. And another variable he found among these successfully married people was parental frankness in matters of sex. Now, Burgess and Cottrell did a similar study in 1939, a little later, and confirmed many of Tierman's findings, and we're not going to look into that study this morning. I just want to add to these variables now some behavioral criteria of maturity for which you should seek. See, our society is very confused about when a person becomes an adult. An adult, in our cultural context, is supposed to mean a mature human being. Unfortunately, there are many adults that are still struggling with some stages of emotional childhood and adolescence and seem to be hopelessly hung up there. But when we're 12, we have to start paying adult prices to amusements. In the state of Ohio, at 14, our state says that a young person is mature enough to know which parent he wants to live with when his parents are sufficiently immature to have to divorce. At 16, in most states, they say we are mature enough to take a motor vehicle on the highway. At 18, we can die for our country or vote for a new president. At 21, we finally reach the magical age where they say we are responsible for our economic debts. Now, when you look at this conglomeration of chronological criteria for maturity, is it any wonder that our young people wonder, when in the world are we considered to be adults? At 12, 14, 16, 18, or 21. I'd like to give you four behavioral criteria this morning that ignores age levels. First of all, a mature person is responsible for himself. A young man tells you he's going to pick you up at 7:30 on Friday night for a date and he doesn't show up to 9. He's telling you something about how responsible he is. And if he can't be responsible for himself, how's he going to be responsible for the maintenance of a household? Second criteria, a mature person is responsible for his mate. Thirdly, a mature person is responsible for his offspring. And fourthly, a mature person is responsible to his community. Now, when you look at those criteria, there aren't as many mature people around as we thought, are there? Some people have characterized our culture as a community of perpetual adolescence. But success in marriage comes to those who manage to grow up and, through a very complicated maze of mate selection, choose an adequately mature spouse. And let me give you finally a tool to do this. Sit down someday when you're alone and list the 10 most essential. First of all, list in writing all the qualities you hope to find in a wife or husband. List them all down. After you have listed all the qualities you hope to find, then choose from them the 10 most essential. And then when you've chosen the 10 most essential, rank them according to their importance from 1 to 10. Now go through the list again and mark with a plus mark those qualities which you find in the person you think you want to become engaged to. And mark with a minus mark those qualities that you don't want to find in a future mate that you may see in the person you're thinking about becoming engaged to. Now, this may assist you in marrying with the head as well as with the heart. But unless you're different from the past generation, you'll tear up the list and do it anyway. But I think I've spread before us a fairly good understanding of our mate selection process, some of the ways in which you may use it to minimize the risk in mate selection. And now I'm very interested to hear the reactions of our panel.
Gentlemen, please join me. I don't want to do this alone. As you remember, when the panel was introduced, we have a psychologist, a sociologist, a medical doctor, and a foreign missionary. I will probably tell everyone where the washrooms are, and I'll let these gentlemen answer the hard questions. I couldn't resist asking Dr. Brock before the chapel service if he was going to comment on the premarital arrangements that are done in Nigeria, Africa, where he was a missionary. I don't think he's made up his mind yet whether he's going to respond to that. But we do want to somewhere along the line entertain the various cultures and how they cope with their. I would like to ask an opening remark from Dr. Frank Maple, and he may say anything he wants to say, and if you care to, when he has done something that you cannot resist asking, go ahead and we'll entertain a question based on his remarks. Dr. Maple.
We say that, first of all, I'm sure Dr. Dobbin has been congratulated many times before, but I do not know of a lecture that I've heard that's ever put out things more succinctly with Christian attitudes than his this morning. I did, however, was interested in the fact that as a psychologist, he did get over on my side when he talked about sags and bags. And I thought perhaps that we might build a new corporation that would be able to rejuvenate us if we go to the moon, because there would be much less gravity.
And other things.
See, I'm reminded, however, of a non-Christian who wrote many truisms, though, in a man by the name of Robert Ardrey. Robert Ardrey was a playwright. He was actually trained as an anthropologist at the University of Chicago. He has written two books which I think are extremely important to my understanding of human behavior, not Christian behavior, of animals and us. And they are African Genesis and Territorial Imperative, of which many sociologists will be unhappy, perhaps, with my mentioning them. But there's some very important truisms that he brought out this morning that I thought was important. First of all, what is masculinity insofar as man out here in the community, or a man himself in this world, sees himself? And the surprising thing is that the male person is much more interested in the end, the strong male person, in the territory that he controls or has the responsibility for than he is in sex. And I think this was amply demonstrated this morning when he said that the person who is insecure as a male has to prove his masculinity, and therefore this leads to problems of short-circuiting the number two random, which is so important in dating, and secondly, of having problems of premarital sexual intercourse, or having problems of having extramarital sexual intercourse. Those, friends, are the problems of an insecure person, not a secure person. The Don Juan is not what he seems to be. The other thing that I thought I would like to bring out, and that is, in my own church, the Episcopal Church, we had a two-day seminar for marriage counselors, marriage counseling in the priesthood, in the pastor's offices, where much of this does occur, unfortunately so. And one of my fine psychiatrist friends from St. Louis was down and gave this two-day seminar. And he said that in all of his experience, he does not know one case of people who have premarital sexual intercourse or extramarital sexual intercourse that it does not hurt and continue to hurt both themselves and the partner. So consequently, if you want to reduce the risk of our lives and ensure ourselves on the side that's really going to allow us to be a vehicle for the Holy Spirit, then obviously this is an area that one must avoid. It's like going over the precipice. We still have gravity. We're gonna fall flat on our faces. So consequently, these few remarks I hope will be things that will be of good help for you. Thank you.
Thank you. Does anyone care to pose a question for Dr. Maple? If not, you can frame it and hold it, but some burning issue that you want. I'd like to just open a can of worms, if I may, and say that and I'm addressing this to Dr. Maple. Were the remarks of this psychiatrist based on the Western, by that I mean European and American, culture, or did he include in his statement all cultures? For example, where you have an extended family, a clan system, a matriarchal society where polygyny is accepted as a practice?
Yes. This was meant to be an equation of the Western society as you and I see it. However, even in a matriarchal society, going back to Ardre again, let's take the Indians, for instance, which is a good example. Still, the females are still the ones who are interested in the home. They're the interested ones in having children, of seeing that what goes on the inside of the home is their prime prerequisite. Whereas the male is outside, he wants to see what is happening in his community, how he is home as part of this community, of course. But it also is a question how he's going to protect it and how he's going to enlarge it as time goes on. So actually, still, even in a matriarchal society, the male is strong if he takes this role.
I lived in a matriarchal society when I was a missionary in Central Africa, and I think we discovered there, just through observation, not through any depth counseling, certainly, we discovered there a very serious problem as it relates to the ministry, in that the women of that society, which is a clan system, matriarchal, horrors, but when one marries into one of those clans, he has to build a house next door to his future mother-in-law before he's given in marriage, and then he's got to live there for 2 years on trial, and it probably is that, you know. After which period of time he can be rejected by the clan, saying, "You're not going to fit into our clan, and we want you to take your cows and go home and give us back our girl." Now, we faced real problems there in the young people, trying to teach them what they said was a Western ethic, which counteracted what their fathers and mothers taught them. Would you have any remark on that? Or maybe we want to ask Dr. Snyder this, as a sociologist. He's probably studied cultures more than any of us.
Well,
do you see the problem as we faced it there in dating?
I certainly do not claim to be any authority in terms of preaching the gospel on the Christian ethic of strange cultures, because I know that in many cases we have had to modify, from my own secondhand information, we've had to modify our own Western culturally learned concepts, as long as they were not direct violation of Christian New Testament rules. But I realize this has ramifications in terms of polygamy, as well as the trial marriage, which you have mentioned. So all I can say is I recognize the problem, but I do it no better how missionaries deal with that problem.
Well, they usually come home and discuss it.
Dave, let me suggest what the African church came up with as a solution to a similar problem. In Nigeria, when a fellow dies after he's married, if he has not produced a male heir to be part of the family lineage, the wife becomes the property of her father-in-law to produce a male heir, and will not be free until she has produced one, which automatically forces her into an adulterous situation. The native church came along and said, "This is not right for our girls, and we won't let them be submitted to it." So the churches would get together, raise the price of the dowry, and buy her from this polygamous father-in-law. Then she would be free to marry someone else. And then when, let's say, a Christian man would come and marry this young widow, then he would pay the dowry to the church rather than to the in-laws, and it satisfied native law and custom. It was also consistent with their New Testament
I think what I'm trying to get at here is that, not missions, but there is a cultural overhang that all of us live under, because when you study sociology in college, psychology, you're always hit with this. Well, this is the way they do it in Africa, and it always seems like it's ideal, it's beautiful, it's free, it's liberated, you run off in the woods and wowee, and you know. And I think this does pose tremendous problems for our young people here, because they're aware of these things, and certainly the desires and the, I don't like the word urge, but for lack of a better word right now, are the same biologically, physiologically. And I'd like for our panel just to feel free to respond to this aspect in America. Is there something that we're doing wrong in the church that is repressing young people, holding them down? Is there some way we can throw the windows open, get a little fresh air on the subject, much like Dr. Dobbins did this morning? What could be done in young people's groups, for example, to acquaint them?
Well, I would like to respond in terms of the cultural situation. Now, we, full gospel, and to a certain extent in the evangelical world, are a subculture in American society. And we have been accused over the years through the literature and through the public pronouncements of psychologists of having produced inhibitions among our young people that have hindered them in terms of happiness in marriage. And this has been a very interesting question to me, which I have dealt with and sought answers for. I think the best way to explain it in a moment or two would be the birth control idea. Now, the Catholic Church, of course, has a rigid position in terms of their official position, but anyone needs who knows the size of Catholic families in America knows that the lay people have long since abandoned any sense of obedience to the authority. And this is also true of the Mormon Church. The Mormon Church has even stronger religious reasons for having large families than the Catholics, because it is based upon a theology that extends on into eternity. The larger the family, the more you're doing the will of God in a wider sense even than the Catholic position. And yet Mormons are practicing birth control, which means that they have changed their views in keeping with the cultural edict. Now, in terms of the Pentecostal people, as well as others, I think the same thing is true in terms of guilt about sex. Even though we admit that in our early history there was so much negativism about sex and so much hush-hush about it, that it would inevitably produce inhibitions. I think the fact is that most of our people have actually outgrown that sort of binding effect it would have upon their happiness. In fact, in my own study, I found that this was true, that there was not the guilt that we have been taught existed in marriage. One of my friends spoke of how this guilt was expressed by a young lady who said that she couldn't enjoy going to bed with her husband because she felt that her mother was standing by the bedside pointing at her. And he thought, this man was a secular counselor, he thought this was widespread among rigid fundamentalists. But I find that this is just not true. Either we have grown in terms of the infiltration of a more generous attitude from our culture, or we've just gathered this from our parents, from our pastors, and so on over the past few years. And I find that there isn't the inhibitions that many people feel that there are. And then there's another thing, of course, that's at work here, and that's the ameliorating power of conversion. People are converted and filled with the Holy Spirit. In spite of inhibitions, they work out happiness in their interpersonal relationship in marriage. Both of these things are going on all the time. And I was very interested in Dr. Dobbins' speech because he was very sociological. I could read it all the way through. And when he spoke about the self-fulfilling prophecy sort of thing, if your parents have been happy, you are more likely to be happy in marriage. And I think that is an extremely significant thing. And we have more realism today in the full gospel than we have ever had in terms of what is happiness. instead of this idealistic concept that you never argue in a home, for example, you never disagree in a home, I think we've come to a place where we recognize that disagreement is normal, even to Christians. But it's how you settle your disagreements that Christians have learned. And when young people grow up in a home where there are disagreements in terms of differences of opinion, but the difference of opinion is solved in an excellent Christian manner, they learn from this and they identify with it. And they're not completely thrown when the first year, months, years of marriage, when the differences of opinion arise. All of this I have found from my own study are healthy signs. And even this seminar today, I visited CBI, as it was known then 30 years ago, mentioned the word sex on the campus anywhere.
Start a revival.
Start a revival. Of
I must give you an aside on Dr. Snyder, which I thought was really charming. He told me that this was the point or the thing that he dealt with at length in his dissertation, that Puritanical negativism did not inhibit, you know, interpersonal relations in marriage. He said this was picked up by the United Press International and put all over the world, and also it was reprinted in Playboy, and he quickly informed me that he had not read it in Playboy, but he had heard that. Yes.
One time, and I felt that was helping get rid of some of this oppression of random dating. But really, when I was a student here, if you were in the dining room twice, you were going together. If it was three times, you were engaged, and if it were four times, you were secretly married and didn't have the nerve to tell it. And I think this did not stem from any of the administration or the staff. I think it was a preconceived mental set of the students themselves, and basically from those who were not getting involved as much as they wanted to, so they projected it as a defense mechanism. So I think you can handle it.
Yes.
I want to pick up that inquiry and tie it in with Dr. Maple's remark before I sat back here and made a little note about territorial imperative. I'm familiar with that book, but I haven't read it. I'm going to go back and look it up in the library and read it, because it has some very interesting implications in regards to this inquiry. The building of a secure person doesn't start at 15. Starts at birth. And if we look at Erickson's 8 stages of man, we'll find that as parents love a newborn child, and let me show you how complicated this is. I thought I might remark on this just at the end of my lecture, and then I backed away from it because you can't say everything in one morning. Mental health is let me put it this way. Emotional disturbance is such a virulent thing that one generation is seldom sufficient to cure it. When you talk to people who deal in human problems, psychiatrists and psychologists, they will tell you that if there is an emotional disturbing pattern of behavior in a family, you are very fortunate if the flow of life through three or four generations of that family find the offspring free from it.